For those of you who aren't runners, this is the sound you hear at the starting line for the Hospital Hill Run, a half marathon that climbs the winding streets around Children's Mercy. It's known as one of the more grueling runs in Kansas City. Marathons are exciting for the cities that host them and the people who run them. But when it comes to running, is more always better? Today's guest suggests that maybe we're not born to run, or at least not quite that far. I'm Gina Kaufman. It's Central Standard Time. Cardiologist James O'Keefe with us from St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute. Good morning.
Morning, Gina.
So you've been raining on kind of a lot of marathon runners' parades lately. Are you holding up okay?
Yeah, I say if I show up at races, I have to wear a flak vest. So no, but I'm an athlete myself. I've always loved to run. And so, I think probably the first disclaimer to make is that exercise is as good as we've always known it is, personally and from a scientific standpoint. But yeah, like everything in life, you know, it's really not that surprising, right?
Moderation.
Moderation, yeah.
Well, so tell us the story of the first marathon, the ancient Greek tale of the messenger who ran 26 miles to deliver a message.
Yeah, people sort of forget about that. So Pheidippides was this herald messenger for a living. He ran messages around ancient Greek, you know, battle sites and whatnot. And he, this was like 491 BC, and there was this Greco-Persian war going on, and it was apparently a critical juncture. So it was a busy time for Pheidippides. And like for the 48 hours before this last day, he had run like 150 miles. And then he woke up the next day, the third day, kind of sore and stiff. But lo and behold, during that day, the Greeks defeated the Persians. And he had a big message to deliver back to the people of Athens. So it was about 26 miles away from this battle in Marathon, Greece. And he ran in there. By the time he got there, he delivered the message, "Victory is ours," and he collapsed and died.
Right. So this is an auspicious beginning to a popular hobby.
Yeah, right. And, you know, nobody, it was sort of commemorated in this legend of Pheidippides. But in 1894 or whatever, when the first marathon, the first modern Olympics was held, they decided to commemorate this thing and call it a marathon and ran it 26 miles from Marathon into Athens. And so that was the beginning of that race, really.
The part of that, I mean, I had actually heard that story before, but the part of it that I haven't heard before is that he was always doing these runs and always delivering these messages.
Oh, yeah,
like,
so
I thought he was maybe just an untrained guy in sandals running 26 miles.
Right. So, you know, and some people, like the last 4 or 5, 6 miles of the marathon can be really tough. They say you hit the wall and stuff, and people sometimes wear shirts that said, "Why couldn't it had only been 18 miles from Marathon to Athens?" But so the thing is, this guy Pheidippides, he'd been doing this his whole life, and he was 41. I mean, he was a seasoned, I bet he was the fittest guy in Athens. You know, he ran 10, 20 miles a day, I bet. And so he was extremely fit, and it kind of is an insight into you know, how you get into trouble with running. It's not like, you know, people say they want to run a marathon. I say, fine, no big deal. Run a marathon or two, you know, but cross it off your bucket list and find a healthier sort of long-term exercise.
Why is it that the fittest guy in Athens would drop dead at the end of running this distance?
So it's complicated, and it's also multifactorial, and it's also very low risk. But the kind of people that do get into trouble, like the guy who book Born to Run, he was like one of the famous ultra marathoners in the world, a guy named Micah True, and same thing happened to him. He was about 58. What happens is with real prolonged endurance exercise, we can get an overstretching of our heart and get some mild damage to the heart, and over time it can cause accelerated aging in the heart and fibrosis, and it can set up the environment that could produce potentially dangerous rhythms.
What do you mean by stretching? That doesn't seem like it's something that would be bad. We stretch our muscles for their own good all the time.
Yes. Yeah, so, Gina, like when you and I are sitting here talking in a relaxed fashion, our heart's beating about 5 liters a minute, about 5 quarts a minute. Circulating around. And if you look down at your hand and make a fist, that's about the size of your heart. So imagine your heart pumping along 5 quarts a minute. Yeah, that's manageable, right? We go out and go for a run, you and I, which is a great thing to do. I still am a runner. I love to run. But when we're running, we're pumping 25, 30 liters a minute. Highly trained athletes, up to 35, 40 liters a minute. Think about that. 40 liters a minute, your heart's the size of your fist. It's working hard. It's an amazing organ. And it's designed to do that for short periods, maybe 30 minutes. By 60 minutes, so part of how it works is it stretches out. But by 45, 60 minutes, we sort of burned through the antioxidants circulating in our bloodstream. Like any engine, if you run it hard, it throws off a lot of smoke. And that smoke can sort of corrode us and cause damage. And so when we're exercising more than an hour at a time, hard, intense, uninterrupted exercise, it starts to sort of potentially cause some damage. And it is easier to understand this concept when you think about cars, especially when I'm talking to guys. I tell them, you know, it's kind of like a car. If you're going to design it to be the fastest, strongest, you know, vehicle that's going to win the Indy 500, it's going to look different than the car that's going to go 100,000 or 400,000 miles.
That's going to last on the road over time.
Right. That's going to hold up, you know. And that's probably a good example. You and I were talking before the show. Like, so how I kind of got some intuition into this, I was, you know, being sort of a hyperactive kid. My kids sort of have accused me of self-medicating my ADHD with exercise, which there might be some truth to that. It's a kind of a coping mechanism.
I think lots of people self-medicate in all kinds of ways with exercise.
Right. Right. And you want to cheer you up or calm you down or wake you up or, you know, just re-energize you. Exercise does all that. I love exercise and I still do it, you know, most every day. But I was getting really competitive about it. Got into triathlons and sprint distance triathlons and I was pushing myself really, really hard and train really hard. And when I got to be middle age, say about 45, about like 13 years ago, when I would go really hard, I'd kind of start feeling like my heart wasn't happy afterwards. I used to feeling
like
stronger.
What did that feel like?
You know, like I'd get a little irritable. I'd feel some palpitations, you know. Being a cardiologist, I mean, I knew I was going to be a cardiologist when I was 12 because I was always fascinated with the heart and I was always exercising. And so, like, I'm much more attuned, I think, than a lot of people are. So I could tell that this was not really going well.
And just
so
it didn't feel right.
It didn't feel right, you know. So I started looking into this and started working. I have a lot of connections around the world with, you know, really smart people who have databases, and we started looking at various things. And sure enough, it shows that although exercise is probably the single best thing you can do to improve both the quality of your life and the quantity of your life, that if you overdo it, you lose a lot of the benefit, if not all of the benefit.
Tell me about the research and the data that support this idea. I mean, there might be a lot of people out there who are feeling kind of dumbfounded by the notion because maybe they've experienced a sense of improved well-being from doing exactly the kind of activities you're saying are ultimately not that great for us.
Well, I don't know. Have you ever done a marathon?
No, I am an avowed non-runner.
So most people, I ran one marathon. Yeah. And I got to tell you, it didn't feel good at the end of it. I mean, my knees were sore and I was sore for days. And I was 24 at the time. And I mean, I could just feel inflammation throughout my system. So anybody who does things like marathons, let alone ultra marathons, running 100 miles, I mean, you know, these are amazing things and you gear up to do them and stuff. But it's not really, shouldn't be that much of a surprise that it's really not the best thing to do for longevity. And that's what we're talking about here. That's two different things. Peak fitness is one thing, but when you're exercising for longevity, it's more like walking, light jogging. This latest study we did from the Copenhagen City Heart Study with Peter Schnorr, who's the senior author on the paper, it was several thousand Danish people followed for decades and looking, and sure enough, the joggers lived longer than the non-joggers. And by running a light to moderate amount,
How much is a light to moderate
amount?
So
in this study, it was like an hour to about 2.5 to 3 hours per week was ideal. So if you want to go, if you in that study, the ideal running regimen for improving life expectancy was 20 minutes of light, slow jogging 2 or 3 times a week.
So I feel like maybe I've inadvertently conjured you or something, because my whole, I engage in what I'd call kind of wimpy exercise. I mean, I like to exercise, but not in these sort of intense go get 'em kinds of ways. I like a long walk. I like to do yoga. I'm not the ultra runner. I'm far from that. And I've sort of accepted that most people view that as a pretty wimpy approach to exercise, but I feel sort of weirdly validated by what you're saying.
Yeah, you shouldn't feel weirdly validated. You should feel, absolutely validated. And, my grandmother was a good example. Dorothy, I lived with her in medical school, and she was a good example. She lived to be 103, and I never saw her run, but she would go out walking. She loved to garden. She loved to garden. And so swimming is an ideal thing. Walking is just as good for you as running when it comes to longevity, although you have to do about twice as long to get the same benefit. So it takes a little long, not distance, but, it's going to take longer time in walking. But things like you mentioned yoga, it's a great exercise. It's not going to get your heart rate up, but it's good for calming your system down. It's good for your heart. It's good for, preventing depression, back injuries. Walking, swimming, you mentioned, really great exercise. So that's what I tell people too, is like they say, but I just can't, 20 minute jog 3 times a week is not enough. I said, well, there's lots of different kinds of exercise, so you could.
So you could complement that with other things, because to what you're saying, I do know long distance runners who have experienced really dramatic positive changes in their lives physically and emotionally since they took it up. And obviously what feels good isn't always actually good for us. But even from the outside, the improvements in these people's lives appear real.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And even on their labs, you look at their HDL cholesterol goes up, their risk of diabetes goes down, they burn off a lot of fat. Not to mention, it's a great way to improve exercise. And a lot of people, that's their social group. It's like they go out on these long runs or long bike rides or whatever. So I'm not really discouraging people from doing that. It's there's a lot of things we do in our life that we're not doing it to live longer, right? You're not climbing Mount Everest or jumping out of an airplane or racing motorcycles or, a lot of things that people do for the thrill of it or the fun or the camaraderie or the challenge. And so this is like that too. It's a challenge. There's a lot of positive things to it. But just understand, if you're doing marathons for living longer, it's not the right exercise. You shouldn't be running more than 20 or 25 miles a week. Or beyond that, you start losing some of the benefits. And if you're running 30 or 35 miles a week or more, your longevity is not different than somebody who doesn't do any exercise. So from my standpoint, it's kind of like, it's a waste of effort. It's like, just ease it off. People say, it's not enough exercise. I say, well, rather than going for your 10-mile run, why don't you think about circling back home after 20, 30 minutes or 40 minutes at the most? And if you need more exercise, like a lot of people do, do some weightlifting or do some yoga or, the best exercise of all, if you're looking for a physical activity that confers health and longevity and good sort of sense of well-being, is get intimate with your significant other.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there studies
Activity is, if nothing else, exercise. And when you do studies on that, regular sexual activity with a steady partner is the best exercise you can do. So I tell people, you don't need to go for this big, long slog. It's save a little time and invest some emotional and physical energy in the person you love.
This is interesting advice that I wasn't expecting today on this show, but I like it. So let's see. I watched your TED Talk and you use a phrase that I think is really interesting. It's sort of a play on Darwin's survival of the fittest. You say that maybe that should be amended in this case to survival of the moderately fit. Can you explain what you mean by that? Because I do think most of us equate fitness and life expectancy and see health as health. The idea that the moderately fit person is winning this longevity race is interesting.
Yeah, Gina, it's very counterintuitive in some ways. But so first, again, let me say that if you go from unfit to fit, it's dramatic improvements, not only in quality of life, but life expectancy. About the best thing you can do is to get fit. But the point is, you don't need to run a marathon or do a triathlon to get fit. So it turns out that, like the other things we've looked at, that the longevity benefits plateau at about 10 or 12 METs. So if you can lightly jog like 5-6 miles an hour, 6.5 miles an hour on a treadmill for a couple minutes without having to stop, you're about at the point that you get the full benefits of being fit.
So fit mean, is fit quantifiable? Is that how you
Yeah, we can quantify fitness by like maximum oxygen uptake or, you know, ability to exercise on a bike or a treadmill. And you know, so as a cardiologist, that's what I've always thought. That's my gold standard. I want to be as fit as possible. And it was really me driving myself more than anything else. But then I started looking at this and then realizing, you know, I was getting injured and my heart was getting a little irritable. And this was like a decade ago. And we started looking into the research and it really confirmed that, like, these days I run 2-3 times a week with my dogs, maybe 2 miles, and then I walk with my wife or my daughter, or I do yoga a couple times a week. I lift weights 2-3 times a week. I try to swim, you know, but I've backed off the intensity a lot.
So I guess I'm hearing that fitness is one thing, and then this sort of ambition that gets attached to these big projects is maybe not a part of fitness. It reminds me of this girl I used to know who she participated in a study in college, one of these graduate cardiology studies, and she was hoping to hear at the end of it that she had an amazing heart, and they told her heart was normal, and she was disappointed, and they tried to explain to her that you can't have an exceptional heart, that hearts are either fine or not fine. Is that kind of what you're saying here?
Yeah. So there is something called the athlete's heart that, you know, you take people who are really, really fit people and their hearts do look different than normal people. They're bigger, they're thicker, they're more powerful. But that tends to come back to normal when they kind of detrain and get back to a normal sort of activity pattern. But yeah, so the thing is that, you know, like another great exercise, as I mentioned earlier, is gardening. So there's an old Chinese saying that says, if you want to be happy for an hour, have a drink or two. If you want to be happy for a weekend, get married. If you want to be happy for a week, take a sunny vacation. But if you want to be happy for a lifetime, garden. And, you know, gardening, and this time of year, it's almost springtime. I love to garden. There's something about nurturing and getting there, digging in the dirt and getting those microbes, you know, that we're finding out that the dirt is good for us. You know,
so this is like a lifestyle thing. I wonder if the relationship between the extreme inactivity of the typical daily American lifestyle and extreme exercise habits, if there's something there, like that we don't live lives where we're just doing things, most of us, like gardening as part of our normal routine, things that are physically active and not quote-unquote exercise. So do you think that as long as we have kind of an extremely inactive lifestyle that there will be people gravitating toward maybe unhealthy extremes of exercise to make up for it?
Yeah, I think that's probably a really, really good sort of observation, Gina, that Americans, we tend to be extreme about things. And I've never had research that's been so misunderstood as this. You know, like the people on the couch use this as validation saying, yeah, see, exercise is bad for you. And then the people at the other end who are doing the, you know, the ultra extreme marathons are like, you know, sending me death threats.
And like, seriously, death threats?
Well, no, but I've gotten a lot of hate mail and people saying sort of mean and nasty things about me, like I'm making this up and, you know, it's like I have an agenda. It's like I don't. I mean, I'm just trying to do the best for my patients and me and my family, figure this out. But that's exactly right. It's like you be moderate about it and you come to the middle and it's actually a heartening message. It's like, you know, no pain, no worries. You don't need to be killing yourself. It's like if you're doing it for longevity, you don't need to get over this big. In fact, one of my favorite things to tell patients to do is get an activity tracker, like a Fitbit or a Garmin VivoFit. Wear it around and get your steps during the day. It's like today it's going to warm up a little bit. There's a nice park, you know, the Kauffman Park right in the vicinity here before I go back to work. I'll probably go walk 10 minutes and get 1,000 steps or something. And I tell my patients, do that. You know, sprinkle it through the day and don't worry if it's not getting your heart pounding, that kind of stuff. You just need to be moving more.
Do you have a question for cardiologist James O'Keefe? Call 816-235-2888. Central Standard's headed to a short break, but we'll take your calls when we return. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're getting some surprising information about the effects of long-distance running and other endurance athletics on the heart. Our guest is James O'Keefe. He's the Director of Preventive Cardiology at St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute. Hi, James.
Hi, Gina.
So for those who have just tuned in, why don't you recap your argument? Because it's a pretty nuanced one, and people could hear a quick little synopsis and maybe get the wrong idea. So the argument that you've been making is?
Exercise is the best thing you can do, but you want to shoot for light to moderate exercise and not overdo the intensity either. Although I do like high-intensity interval training, like 8 intervals of 20, 30 seconds, hard as you can go, you know, running in the grass or something, and then rest and redo that. That's perfectly healthy and a great way to get fit without, you know, beating up your heart and your joints. But and competitive running is fine, but I tell people to shoot for 5Ks and 10Ks. And a half marathon is, I think, a reasonable thing to do occasionally as well. But for marathons, I really don't recommend more than about, you know, I mean, do one or two and then find healthier long-term exercise patterns. Now, granted, it is important to point out this is all observational studies. You know, we don't randomize people. That's our gold standard. It's randomize somebody to run marathons for 50 years and somebody to sit on the couch for 50 years. It's like smoking or alcohol or a lot of things. We can't do those kind of studies. So we have to rely on observational data, which is, you know, fraught with sort of, I mean, this is a hypothesis still, okay?
A hypothesis. Okay, so when you don't randomize studies, how do you get the information about these people?
Well, so you look at large numbers of people over long periods of time, and you do a lot of statistical analyses to adjust for the fact that people who run tend to be healthier, you know, on
average. Maybe they're also eating better.
Right. They're not smoking. It's a healthy lifestyle. And the other important point, Gina, is that people should not be I don't want the runners out there to stop running. I just want them to moderate and maybe cross train a little more, do more yoga, those kinds of things. But it should also lower the barrier for somebody who is sedentary. There's at least half of America, at least half, if not more, that aren't getting nearly enough exercise. They're sedentary, and that predisposes to all sorts of problems. So they should feel like you don't need to go out for a 3-mile run. Even if you go for a 1-mile walk, for starters, and you get massive benefits from that on a
regular basis.
You mentioned
earlier that a lot of the reasons why people run are not necessarily longevity, that there are other things that motivate people, and that there are other things that motivate people to do all kinds of other stuff, like you mentioned, you know, jumping out of airplanes with a parachute or something like that, that we're doing them for other reasons. How do you, as a physician, as a medical professional, sort of incorporate that knowledge and that understanding of all the reasons why people do things and life quality versus life expectancy? How do you incorporate that into the message that you send to people?
So as a physician who focuses really on prevention, I think it's so important these days that we take ownership of our health. And this is a key component of it. So I just advise people. It's like I advise people not to smoke and give them. But this is an easier one. You know, like a lot of people who are exercisers complain about it. But I backed off my exercise from like 7 hours a week of high intensity, you know, just grind it out, hammer, and just trying to be the fittest as I've ever been, to like this more gentle sort of non-competitive, you know, friend. And honestly, I like it. You know, the other important point to make is if you're 15 or 20 and you're on a competitive team and you're running cross country track, don't worry about it. This is fine. When we're young, we are so resilient and we hammer it and we break down tissue and we rebuild it better than before. You know, that's why, you know, Olympic champions are in their 20s typically. Okay. But the point is, don't pretend you're an Olympic champion when you're 50. Or even 40. I mean, you could do it, but understand that you don't rebuild that tissue as much, and you end up with scar tissue and an irritable heart and probably accelerated atherosclerosis and all that kind of stuff. It's like, you know, don't pretend you're 20 when you're not.
What do we know about the heart's capacity in general? I mean, at different ages, and just what makes this machine run the best it can?
So that's another sort of interesting analogy to the automobile, is that there is this longstanding centuries-old theory that the heart has only so many beats in it. And if you look across species, you know, like a hummingbird, Gina, has a heart rate of 1,200 or 1,300 beats per minute. It has a life expectancy of about 1.5 years. A Galapagos turtle can live 170 years. Charles Darwin's turtle that he brought back to England just died at 170 years of age just a couple years ago. It has a pulse of 8. So if you do the math, it's like we got about 2 or 3 billion beats. If in America today, if you live to be 90, that's 3 billion beats. And so it's like if you're running a marathon once a week, you're wasting a lot of heartbeats. Whereas if you're running 2 or 3 miles, 2 or 3 times a week, you have a lower heart rate the rest of the day. And so the math averages out that even if you're being a guess, that would be the best way to get your heart fit and have it last for 90 years.
We've got some calls that I want to bring in on this conversation. Let's talk to Jim in Overland Park. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go on. What do you want to share?
Well, you're touching on it a little bit here in your previous comments, but it's about maximum heart rate. My doctor told me a few years ago that I should elevate my heart rate at or near its maximum periodically. So the first part of the question is that.
Are you walking right now? I think I can hear your footsteps.
I am. I'm in the midst of about a 6-mile walk at about 4 miles per hour.
Perfect.
So, okay.
So the second part of the question then was, if that's good advice, how often should a person do that? And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thanks very much. Good show.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, so that's another good question. It is good to get your heart rate up and sort of blow the cobwebs out of there from time to time. That's the high-intensity interval stuff. But you don't need to keep it up there for an hour. Like I say, you could do it for 20, 30 seconds and get your heart rate up to max and then bring it back down and bring it back up again. That's good for you. So, but on the other hand, you know, if you're just that idea of, I don't really encourage people that much to wear heart rate monitors and to really focus on that. Just go by how you feel and don't worry about, again, if you're training to set a personal record, then you need to do that. But if you're training to live a long, full, healthy, happy life, don't worry about it.
Let's hear from Rick in Kansas City. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi. Great program this morning, and especially to have a cardiologist talking about exercise, because there's so many different approaches out there and so many different, you know, methods and books and coaches and everything telling people, you know, lots of different approaches to take. I like to walk, and I do it fast, and I try to take real long strides and go up an incline instead of run, just because running, I think, I'm a regular-sized person, but it just seems to be hard on my knees and my back. But you've kind of already touched on this, but the walking, it gets, especially if I go up a hill, it seems to get my heart rate up, and it gives your body, your legs and everything a pretty good workout, because it's hard work. And I tend to think it's better than running, because I see a lot of people run and they're just going such a slow pace that it doesn't even really seem to work your legs or your lungs that much. But could you comment a little bit on that, walking versus running? And also, I'm glad you touched on that high intensity training where you bike real hard or you sprint for 20 seconds. Could you talk a little bit more about that, about how a person would go about that?
So, yeah, those are great comments. And walking is as good as running. It's great to walk briskly. And a lot of people like you feel that they have fewer injuries. Walking upstairs is a great way. In fact, walking or running upstairs is one of my favorite interval training. I did it yesterday. So
much like on a Stairmaster.
Yeah, yeah. You go hard on a Stairmaster, hard as you can go for, you know, 30 or 50 seconds, and then walk down the stairs or, you know, slow it way down, and then do that 8 times. Take you 10, 20 minutes, and it's a phenomenal workout. So the thing about walking you can do it. You tend not to get injured. So Hippocrates is a father of medicine, and 2,500 years ago, he was actually a contemporary of Pheidippides way back then. And it's just amazing the wisdom when I read about some of these cultures, like the cultural wisdom. He said, walking is man's best medicine. That was 2,500 years ago. He also said, if we could give the right amount of nutrition and exercise, not too much, not too little, it's the safest way to health. So again, Hippocrates 2,500 years ago was implying, yeah, you can get too much exercise. I mean, most people get too little, but you want to be moderate about it.
This idea that you've touched on in some of your writings, that medicines, all medicines, have an ideal dosage and are poisonous beyond that, is a compelling one in this context. If exercise is great medicine, does it also have a specific dose to be effective? And if so, how does an average person determine their dose?
Yeah. So, Gina, that's kind of the $1 billion, $1 trillion question I always get. Okay, so what's the right amount?
How many spoonfuls?
Yeah. And it's really true. So if we had a medicine that did everything that exercise did, I'd be out of a job. Literally, it will reduce risk of by 50% or more heart disease, dementia, diabetes, depression, osteoporosis, high blood pressure, all these things dramatically lower with exercise. But moderate exercise is the best. So the right dose, surprisingly, it's a giant wide spectrum. And there's probably 50 or 60% of Americans who aren't getting enough exercise, who are underdosing. And there's only 2 or 3% who are probably overdosing. So overdosing, if you're running more than 25 or 30 miles a week, that's probably too much. If you're exercising intensely more than 5 or 6 hours a week, that's probably too much. That you will not get the full benefits. And this does not include yoga or sort of weight training, but this is continuous aerobic exercise.
Okay. Let's talk to Pat in Liberty.
Oh, and one other point, too. You should at least take one day a week off of vigorous exercise.
What does that do for your heart?
It just needs time to rest and recover. It's absolutely important. You know, that's that kind of compulsive thing, that overachiever. You know, that was me. Like, I was just exercising, you know, 2 days, 7 days a week. That's too much.
Hey, Pat in Liberty, what do you have to share?
Hey, I have a question. I have a husband who's got a history of left main disease with a CABG afterwards, heart surgery, and has now blown through most of his cholesterol medicines and that they're causing severe muscle cramping. He's on his, like, fifth one. He's in his 60s now. He's active but retired, trying to get back on the treadmill, trying to figure out any way he can get off the statins, but is having a lot of trouble. So my question is it better for him to push through and do the exercise 20 to 30 minutes, knowing that he's going to get this cramping later in the night that sometimes wakes him up and literally is screaming in pain? Or where's the middle road here?
Well, so you don't, number one, you don't have to do the exercise all at once. You can sprinkle it through the day. Number two, a lot of people don't tolerate statins, and a good way to get to improve that is to make sure his vitamin D level is normal and take some coenzyme Q10, CoQ10. Those two things really help to reduce the muscle aches and cramping that can allow people to exercise even on statins.
And let's hear quickly from David in Kansas City. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What do you want to add?
I am a patient of Dr. O'Keefe.
Oh, hi, David. I recognize you.
I'm 78 years old. I've run in 100 marathons. I have a heart condition, and I run between 70 and 75 miles a week.
And you still do currently?
I sure still do. I've run for 50 years. So my question to Dr. O'Keefe, my physician, is how does he explain me?
Yes. How is David doing it?
So David is, you know, as I've told him, this is a common conversation David and I have. And I have a lot of athletes who are patients who come to see me. And you know, they know I'm sort of a recovering exercise addict myself. So, David, as I've told you, number one, you are an orthopedic mutant or marvel. It's like the amount of miles you put on your system. And, you know, you need a little tune-up with your heart. But for the most part, his heart is perfectly healthy. And, you know, and that's a good point. It's like we're looking at large populations, and some people tend to hold up under this and others don't. And this is kind of like
we're all different.
We're all different, and everybody's different. You know, some people say, you know, like they smoke because they said, my grandpa smoked a pack of unfiltered Camels all his life, and he lived to be 90. Well, you know, so this is like, these are not hard and fast rules. We're just trying to sort of, and you know, David's a good example too. Running, you know, it's a big part of his life. It's, you know, it's a lot of his friends. It's a lot of his social time. He travels around doing it. He's got all sorts of great stories. He looks great. He's normal weight, you know, so it's not all bad.
Is Kansas City a good place to do this research? And have Kansas Cityans been receptive to your message?
Yeah. I mean, Kansas City has a very active exercise group. And as the message gets out there, and we've published a lot of papers on this now from a lot of different databases, I think the message is being better received, that people understand. I'm not trying to talk anybody out of exercise. I'm just trying to, you know, get us so we all hold up in the long run and are, you know, doing the best thing for our heart besides having a good time at it.
What do you think about just what this information about extreme exercise over prolonged periods of time, kind of regularly, that what is the effect that has on the heart tell us about the heart more generally? Does it tell us something about the heart more generally?
Oh, yeah. So like atrial fibrillation is an increasingly common heart rhythm we see. It's a rapid, irregular beat from a disorganized rhythm up in the atria, and it can predispose to stroke. So one of the most striking things we see in extreme endurance athletes is that it's like a 5 to 700% increased risk of AFib. So I'll see a lot of athletes who come in, say, you know, even above age 30, 35, 40 and on up, where they'll have AFib for no other reason. This is typically somebody that we see in somebody with sleep apnea or obesity or diabetes or heart disease or untreated high blood pressure, excessive alcohol use, or just age. So these people come in with AFib for no other reason. And, you know, it's that overstretching that we were talking about earlier when you're going from 5 quarts a minute to 35 quarts a minute and keeping that massive volume demand up for a long period of time.
Our time is up for this discussion, but James O'Keefe, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Jane. It was a real pleasure.